to make them more and more realistic, until eventually we can discuss those fascinating new results of Monday from the Bicep 2 experiment. Remember, in Minkowski space, the fluctuation spectrum has this behavior. If we take the field averaged over a box of size L, that is, if we look at things up to wavelengths of size lambda, then the amplitude fluctuations are typically of the size 1 over lambda, or 1 over L, where L is the size of the box. This is the standard deviation of the fluctuation. In the case where the field doesn't have a mass term. If it has a mass term, then for large distances, things behave a little differently. It goes to the power of 3/2 rather than 1/2. But for small boxes, this is the behavior. What we see here is that fluctuations of a large spatial size exist, but are generally of a very small amplitude, because it's suppressed for large sizes, for large wavelengths. Large wavelengths, quantum fluctuations are suppressed in Minkowski space. Then we considered a universe which has a period of exponential expansion. There was Minkowski space earlier, then exponential expansion with a Hubble constant h for the time period from eta initial to eta final. A universe with an exponential expansion has this scale factor when we use proper time, that is the proper time of as it is shown on the wristwatch of a freely floating observer that just goes along with the Hubble flow of the expansion without having peculiar velocity. Then when we rescale, when we transform our time coordinate into the conformal time variable, then the same exponential increase takes this form. The scale factor as a function of the conformal time behaves like that. Conformal time, remember, ranges from minus infinity to zero. The zero in conformal time is future infinity. And this is how the scale factor blows up when expressed in terms of conformal time. Eta comes from the negative side, and as it approaches zero from the left, this thing blows up, scale factor blows up. It's the same blowing up of this exponential increase, it's just that we parameterize time differently. Now, we observed that in the Klein-Gordon equation for the auxiliary field chi, the one that doesn't have a friction term, in that mode equation, the frequency squared term, and I simplified it already by dropping the mass term, this frequency squared term can change sign. And we established that this happens when the co-moving mode in question is crossing the Hubble horizon. Remember that a mode of fixed value k, of fixed co-moving momentum k, is a mode, which is to say, a particular wavelength oscillation, where that wavelength is increasing in time along with the Hubble flow, along with the expansion. So the same mode looked at different times will appear to be growing. Not just appear to, it is growing. And eventually, every mode crosses the Hubble horizon. Its wavelength starts to exceed the size of the Hubble horizon. And that's when this expression here flips sign. You see, when eta becomes late, at late times, eta gets close to zero, which makes this thing blow up and eventually exceed that. So the frequency squared goes negative. The frequency, therefore, goes imaginary. And we can tell when that happens. It happens when eta is 1 over k, up to a factor of square root of 2. When eta is 1 over k, the horizon crossing time is 1 over k. which is to say that the horizon crossing time is L, if L is the co-moving wavelength. I carelessly said that every mode crosses the horizon eventually. Well, it depends. Now we only have a finite duration for our exponential expansion, so not every mode will have time enough to grow so that its wavelength starts to exceed the Hubble horizon. Eventually, the inflation ends at eta final, and then we no longer have this Hubble horizon. There are modes, therefore, which we call the small modes that never make it, that never cross the horizon. The inflation ends before the wavelength had the chance to grow to the size of the Hubble horizon. And we found that for those modes, the relationship between the quantum fluctuations amplitude and their wavelength stays the same as in Minkowski space. Quantum fluctuations of large spatial extent are suppressed proportional to 1 over L, where L is the spatial extent. And then there was the case of the medium-sized modes, modes which do cross the horizon at some point while the inflation is happening. That's when this 1 over eta squared term dominates over the k squared term. And what we found then was quite striking. We found that the mode functions, that the mode function of such a mode, after it crosses the horizon, does no longer depend on the co-moving wavelengths at all. And that means, and by the mode function, I mean now the mode function of the physical field phi. Remember, the mode function of the auxiliary field chi was increasing without bound because it was this inverted harmonic oscillator that had a runaway solution. But you go from the auxiliary field chi to the physical field phi by dividing by the scale factor, which also was a runaway explosive function, and the ratio of them goes to a constant. From the point of view of the Klein-Gordon equation of the physical field, that's because the friction term dominates and the harmonic oscillator becomes overdamped. It just doesn't move anymore and freezes. So what we found is that the mode function no longer depends on k after horizon crossing, which is to say that the quantum fluctuations no longer depend on k, because the mode function's modulus was directly giving us the size of the quantum fluctuation. So we found that the quantum fluctuations' amplitude no longer depended on what wavelength they had. As soon as they cross the horizon, the amplitude of the quantum fluctuation stays the same, even though their wavelength grows very quickly. And here's the expression that we obtained for the amplitude of the quantum fluctuations after horizon crossing. We found that the standard deviation of the amplitude of the quantum fluctuations is proportional to the Hubble constant during inflation. We are assuming here exponential expansion with the coefficient h. The faster the exponential expansion is, the larger the coefficient h has to be, right? Because the exponential expansion is e to the power ht. That's the scale factor, h to the power ht. So if h is large, the expansion is quick. The horizon, therefore, is small. Even close neighbors can no longer communicate because the expansion is so rapid. And when h is big, not only does everything happen quickly and the horizon is small, no, also the quantum fluctuations are large. Okay, so when the quantum fluctuations are large, it means that the Hubble constant is large, the exponential is quick, the Hubble horizon, which is of size 1 over h, is small. And here this is just constants, 2 to the power of 3 half, gamma function at 3 half divided by pi. So what we see here is that not only do the quantum fluctuations stay the same after horizon crossing, no, to be precise, they stay the same value that they have when the mode crosses the horizon. So a mode initially has a wavelength that's way smaller than the horizon size. And that means that the amplitude of its quantum fluctuations goes down like 1 over L, 1 over the wavelength. As the wavelength increases, see, as a mode expands along with the universe, its quantum fluctuations decrease in amplitude initially, like 1 over L. The amplitude goes down, L, the wavelength increases of the mode, the amplitude decreases like 1 over L. Until we hit the horizon. And from that point onwards, whatever the quantum fluctuations amplitude was then, it will stay the same. Remember there was this graph, it started out like 1 over L, the quantum fluctuations go down like 1 over L, and then the mode hits the horizon, and then the quantum fluctuations stay the same in amplitude after that. Even if that mode acquires a huge wavelength eventually, and that's the scenario that we are going to consider as realistic, the Hubble horizon may be tremendously small, maybe just 3 orders of magnitude larger than the Planck length, 10 to the minus 31 meters or so, maybe 10 to the minus 30 meters. So modes have their amplitudes of quantum fluctuations frozen in when they cross that size, when their wavelength becomes that large, large in quotation marks, 10 to the minus 30 meters or so. And then as the modes get stretched, perhaps to galactic size, or even larger, perhaps billions of light years in size, they keep that level of amplitude fluctuation. By the way, this only works for scalar fields and fields that can be seen as being of scalar origin. We'll get to more detail about this later on. That's an important comment because most fields in nature are not scalar. For example, all the matter is fermions, and they are not scalars. Scalars always are bosons. And the bosons in nature are usually photons, gluons, W and Z bosons, none of which are scalars. They're all vectorial. And if you go through the same calculations as we did, you don't get that amplification effect. They keep having their quantum fluctuations suppressed at large wavelengths, even when their wavelength is larger than the Hubble horizon.
Mm-hmm. So why do we presume that it's the scalar field that dictates inflation? Why we are just dealing with...
Well, it's because the other fields don't experience that amplification. And the scalar field will also be important as the origin of the dramatic expansion in the first place.
Mm-hmm. You say that the size of the wave of that crosses the horizon remains the same, but it is the core moving then? Is it?
Okay, so during an exponential expansion, the size of the horizon is the same. Yes, so the proper length of the proper size of the horizon, the proper size of it remains the same. Remember, we calculated that. If you have exponential expansion, then any two observers which at any time have a distance larger than such and such will never be able to communicate again. Now, the waves, of course, they change their wavelength. So their wavelengths get stretched out. And so eventually, each wave, if given enough time, will have a wavelength that starts to exceed the Hubble length. But the Hubble horizon itself, constant in size, if the expansion is exponential. Yeah? If it is not exponential, and we will have to go away from the idea that it's exponential eventually, and there's a deep reason for why it's not exponential, then the Hubble horizon will change over time. And it is now thought that the experimental evidence is overwhelming, that we've seen that. We've seen that the Hubble horizon has changed over time, that it has increased a little bit over time. And you can imagine what that means. If the Hubble horizon gets a little larger over time during inflation, then those modes which cross the Hubble horizon late, well, they will cross a larger Hubble horizon than those modes which cross the Hubble horizon early, right? I mean, assuming that the Hubble horizon is getting larger in time, which is to say that the expansion is not quite exponential, it's a little less than exponential. Expansion is slowing down a little bit. Then you have a small horizon at the beginning, while the expansion is still most dramatic, and then the expansion becomes less dramatic, the Hubble horizon gets a little larger. So early modes will cross the horizon when it's still small, and therefore they will have still relatively large quantum fluctuations frozen in. Whereas those modes that cross the horizon late will cross the horizon when it's a little larger, when their quantum fluctuations therefore are a little smaller. So the late modes will have somewhat smaller quantum fluctuations frozen in. The late modes are the smaller ones. So the smaller the mode, the less strong will be the quantum fluctuations that are frozen in. And that is producing a tilt in the spectrum. So here we have no tilt. Quantum fluctuations are the same size, same amplitude for all scales. And the experimental observation is, no, it's not quite constant. There's a bit of a slope, there's a bit of a tilt, which is because the Hubble horizon was supposed to increase a little bit during inflation. And there's a deep reason for that that we will get to today. Okay, so our conclusion was, let's assume that the expansion is exponential, and not just exponential, but really fast. So a large h. Then the Hubble horizon, 1 over h, is very small. And as modes cross the Hubble horizon, their proper wavelength is very small still. And therefore, those modes will have amplitudes of their quantum fluctuations frozen in. I mean, they just dynamically don't change anymore. When those quantum fluctuations are still large, namely proportional to h. And for it is of utmost astronomical significance that those quantum fluctuations stay of the same amplitude even as the modes acquire larger and larger wavelength. So when that time interval of inflationary expansion, of a quasi-exponential expansion, is long enough, then modes with large fluctuations can reach even cosmological size, millions and billions of light years. And therefore, there will be quantum fluctuations of significant amplitude even at such large scales that they can be responsible for seeding the condensation of hydrogen later into galaxies. Just produces a little bit of inhomogeneities, which then act help condense the matter around those little overdensities. Let's do a little preliminary estimating here. If this is the right seeding mechanism for cosmic structure, then the speed of the exponential expansion, the value of the Hubble constant, or really Hubble parameter, as we will later see, because it has a bit of a time evolution during inflation, then how large h is, how fast the expansion was, determines the amplitude of the later observed fluctuations, and that has to conform with observations. We can measure the size of the amplitude of the fluctuations in a cosmic microwave background. We know how inhomogeneous the universe is also from doing the statistics of the distribution of galaxies. All of that has to match. And it is thought that the Hubble length during inflation to achieve all of this has to be around 10 to the 5 Planck length, or even smaller than that. The latest results indicate that, of last Monday, indicate that the Hubble horizon was probably even smaller than this. So about 10 to the minus 29 meters or smaller, which means that the physics that we are talking about is only just a few orders of magnitude away from the Planck length. And that's fascinating, because longer term, we can probably measure these things that the BICEP2 collaboration measured with much higher precision. And then there is a finite chance that we can use this to probe Planck scale physics. Because the Planck scale is only a few orders of magnitude away from what we actually measure. We measure the physics of the Hubble radius crossing. That's when the quantum fluctuations were frozen in. And the physics of the Planck scale is just like maybe 3-4 orders of magnitude away, which means that the corrections to the standard model of cosmology could be of order 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, maybe even 10 to the minus 3. And that might be measurable. So that means that if you work on a model of quantum gravity, try to put it into inflation and see what modification it does to the predictions of inflation, because there is now a fair chance that something is measurable. In any case, it's way better than our chances with accelerators, where we are more than a dozen orders of magnitude away. So for example, if this time interval during which the universe expanded almost exponentially is, for example, from time 10 to the minus 34 seconds to 10 to the minus 32 seconds, so its duration is basically 10 to the minus 32 seconds, which is a number that is realistic. I mean, our model is not yet realistic enough so that we can really match with the experiment. We will try to improve on the realism of our models, but let me just already anticipate that 10 to the minus 32 seconds is a plausible length for the duration of the quasi-exponential expansion. And you might say, well, that's pretty short. 10 to the minus 32 seconds, how much can the universe possibly have expanded during such a short period of time, 10 to the minus 32 seconds? Well, I did a back of the envelope or front of the transparency calculation there. Okay, so let's calculate what the ratio is of the scale factor at the end of the expansion over the scale factor at the beginning of the expansion. E to the power of h and then t final minus t initial. If you put in the numbers, so here we have h, okay. Now, h is determined by the size of the quantum fluctuations, right? Because we know that h determines the size of the quantum fluctuations, but we measure the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, so we have access to h. So we plug those numbers in here, and we find that the ratio of the scales before and after, so the number by which the universe has expanded, comes out to be e to the power of 3 times 10 to the 5, which is basically 10 to the power of 10 to the 5. It's a 1 and then 100,000 zeros. See, so it's easy to get, and that's really a short time of expansion, right? So it's easy to get enormous expansion factors for cosmic inflation to work, for the predictions to be consistent with the model. You can get away with way shorter expansion periods. You only need really a few dozen. You need 10 to the power of, I don't know, 6 or, no, it's more than that, 10 to the power of 30 or something you need really. You don't really need a number with 100,000 zeros. You get away with a number that just has, you know, a few zeros. But it's quite natural to get this sort of a dramatic expansion. So let's make things a little more realistic, and we have to go back to the basics for that. Let us ask, how can a near exponential expansion be caused? What's the origin for this expansion? We now know that if the universe is expanding like that, then we get quantum fluctuations of significantly large amplitude at very large scales. Fine, but what is possibly causing this early expansion? Now let's remember the action of physics, all of it. Well, it starts out with, let's say, the gravity part, we have the cosmological constant, which is known to be quite small. Then there is the Ricci scalar that induces general relativity. Then we have higher order curvature terms, which have to be there, but also which are naturally for on dimensional grounds, you would estimate, you would expect that the prefactors, that the coefficients in front of other terms that that contain curvature come out very small, just on dimensional grounds. And that's also the observation. We have no positive experimental evidence for any one of those higher order curvature terms. When I say that they must be there, it's because perturbation theory generates those terms. If you do renormalization, those terms will be generated, but at a very, very small amplitude. Let us neglect these terms. No experimental evidence for them, so we know ultimately they are there. Then, they generalize general relativity, of course, right? Because if this is the only curvature term, then we get GR. If that stuff is present, we get some modification of it. Well, and then we have the Klein-Gordon action. Here we have it, the quadratic kinetic term for the Klein-Gordon field and the Klein-Gordon field potential. That field in cosmology is called the inflaton field. And then there are all sorts of other fields, quarks and electrons and so on. We will be able to neglect them because they are not subject to this quantum fluctuation amplification. So let us consider this action and, well, what could be the potential for the inflaton field? We don't quite know yet. We don't have a good reason to derive a particular potential for that inflaton field. But the simplest choice is to say, well, it might be that the V of phi is something like an M phi square term, which is not really a potential in the sense that particle physicists would use the term. Particle physicists would just say this is a mass term. But it turns out that in cosmology, this is called a potential term because it doesn't have derivatives in it. And then maybe another term with a phi to the 4 to it. It turns out that in order to get the standard model of cosmology, you don't even need that term. You can get away with just this. Okay, so from that action, we can calculate the equations of motion. By using the action principle, we obtain the equation of motion for the phi field, differentiating the action with respect to phi, the total action that is with respect to phi at equal to 0, we get the classical equation of motion for the Klein-Gordon field, which we, of course, want to quantize. And then by differentiating with respect to the metric and setting the result equal to 0, we get the equation of motion for the metric, which is the Einstein equation, where on the left-hand side we have curvature expressed in terms of the metric, cosmological constant, and we have the energy momentum tensor. This is the energy momentum tensor. This is the energy momentum tensor expresses the energy and the momentum of all physical fields, of all fields in nature. Electrons, quarks, gluons, everything contributes to this. And in particular, the scalar field, the inflaton field, contributes to that as well. Now, how does the inflaton field contribute to the energy momentum tensor? It turns out that in the early universe, apparently the scalar inflaton field contributed most significantly to this, and the other standard model fields didn't. So the energy momentum tensor for a scalar field takes this form. So there's a kinetic term. It looks like a kinetic term. It has derivatives. And then, well, here as well, and then there's the potential. Obviously, the potential has to contribute to the energy momentum tensor. If you're familiar with the energy momentum tensor, the 0,0 component is the energy density. And the II component is called the pressure. The II component is called the partial pressures in the different directions. If this is the energy momentum tensor of a gas, let's say, then literally the II component describes the pressure. Now, we are not describing gases here, but we are describing fields on a more basic level. So we are considering the case where the energy momentum tensor is dominated by our inflaton field's contribution, dominated by this. And of course, the scalar field is not a gas. So it is a bit of a stretch to say that it has a pressure. But it does contribute to the energy momentum tensor. And the usual convention is to call the II components the pressure, even though the contribution may not be from a gas. Okay, so you see the equations of motion that we have to solve are the Klein-Gordon equation and the Einstein equation. So we have two equations for the metric and the scalar field. So we have two unknown fields, the metric and the scalar field, and we have two equations, the Klein-Gordon equation and the Einstein equation. The metric, of course, has many components, but so does the Einstein equation. So you see how they're coupled, right? The T mu nu is expressed in terms of the field. So this is an equation for G and phi. Curvature is not an independent degrees of freedom. It's expressible in terms of the metric. So all of this is an equation in terms of G and phi, and so is that, an equation in G and phi. Just have to solve those two equations, that's all, and quantize them. Obviously, that's way too hard. Let us consider the special case, which is, however, very important, where we have homogeneity and isotropy in the universe. Complete homogeneity and isotropy to keep things very simple. That's, of course, not very realistic. We want to at least consider perturbations around flatness, around phi being constant, and so on. And that's what we will do. You can view the assumption of homogeneity and isotropy also as the choice to consider only the momentum equals zero modes. Momentum equals zero modes for phi or the metric are the modes that are constant. Okay? So when we look at the zero modes, or expressed differently, when we look at the special case of homogeneity and isotropy, then the Klein-Gordon equation and the Einstein equation from the previous slide are becoming differential equations for just phi of t and g of t, and the space dependence drops out. This makes them ordinary differential equations instead of partial differential equations, because there's just one variable left. And our equations now become the following. There's the Klein-Gordon equation. Notice a friction term. We expected that, because it's expressed in terms of phi, not in terms of the chi field. And then the Einstein equation has, which is a tensorial equation, it has a non-trivial zero-zero component. See, if you look at the Einstein equation here, you see it's an equation for a matrix with indices mu and nu, right? All of these terms have indices mu and nu. And it turns out that in the case of homogeneity and isotropy, this equation is diagonal. All the off-diagonal terms are zero anyway. And then we have two kinds of equations emerging from that. One equation when mu equal nu equals zero, and another equation when they are both I, a value from 1 to 3. So here they are, Klein-Gordon equation, and then the 0, 0 component of the Einstein equation, and here the II component of the Einstein equation, where there's no sum in here. But we're assuming isotropy anyway, so whether I is equal to 1, 2, or 3, it's the same thing. Rotation invariance enforces that, and translation invariance. Remember that the energy momentum tensor, according to our assumption here, is dominated in the early universe by the Klein-Gordon field, by the inflaton field. And what is the inflaton field's contribution to the energy momentum tensor? Well, T naught naught, the energy density, also written as rho, the energy density is 1 half phi dot squared plus V of phi, which is very intuitive, I think. It's like a kinetic term plus a potential term, right? That gives us the energy, or more precisely, the energy density. Then the II component, the pressure in the universe, if the only contribution to the pressure is from the scalar field, remember, it's called the pressure even though we don't have a gas, it's just because we're looking at the II components, which would be the pressure if there were a gas. So the pressure components of the energy momentum tensor are given by 1/2 phi dot squared minus the potential. And you see that the sign of this could go either way, positive or negative. Now, why are we doing all of this? Our aim, what was our aim here? We want to identify a mechanism that would cause the universe to undergo a period of almost exponential expansion, so that then that would cause quantum fluctuations to be stretched to large sizes. Now, before we can get to that, let us make some crucial observations. The cosmological constant is also in the game here, and it contributes positively to the energy density and negatively to the pressure. How do we see that? Well, remember, here are the two Einstein equations, 0,0 component, II component. You see that on the left-hand side is the curvature piece, the expansion, and on the right-hand side we have the energy density here and the pressure there. You see that if the cosmological constant is a positive number, it will add to the energy density. However, it contributes negatively to the pressure. Okay, so we see that a cosmological constant, so-called vacuum energy, contributes positively to the energy density but negatively to the pressure. Another observation that we make here is that when we look at these equations here for the energy density caused by the inflaton field and the pressure caused by the inflaton field, and we notice that the energy density has the potential in it, and when the potential, and let us look at the case of the potential being very large. In that case, when the potential V of phi is very large, it dominates over that, and well, yes, the energy density is going to be very large. Interestingly, though, when the potential of the inflaton field is large, for whatever reason, when the potential is very large, the pressure goes negative. This is reminiscent of what the cosmological constant does. In fact, it's the same thing as what the cosmological constant does. Look at it here. A large cosmological constant will make the energy density very large and the pressure also very large, but negative. For very large lambda, pressure and energy density are the same up to a sine. The same thing happens when the potential of the scalar field is, for one reason or another, very, very large. If the potential of the scalar field is very large, then it will make this the negative of that, right? Because you can forget about this constant then here, about that number here. And more than that, when V of phi is very large, it will dominate the right-hand side of this equation. Right? It will dominate T naught naught, V will dominate TII, and if it's larger than lambda, it will dominate the entire right-hand side. So you can have this positive and that negative to the same amount in two ways. Either you have a dominant cosmological constant, or you have a dominant potential. Either way, get the same behavior on the right-hand side, which means you get the same evolution of space-time. Space-time doesn't care whether a cosmological constant is very large and dominates everything, or alternatively, it's not dominant, but a potential is very large and dominates everything. The universe will react exactly the same way. Now, that's what I wrote here. Whenever the potential is very large, and by that I mean larger than phi dot squared half, the kinetic term, then V of phi temporarily plays the role of a cosmological constant. Now, this is a very important scenario. as you will see a little later. In fact, it has to do with one of the biggest scientific ideas ever, perhaps, as you will see today. This is very important, the scenario when this V of phi starts dominating over that. Therefore, cosmologists introduced a number that quantifies how close we are to that scenario. How close are we to V of phi dominating over phi dot squared? And you can easily quantify that by calculating the ratio between the two. So by calculating the ratio of T naught naught and TII, actually the ratio of TII over T naught naught, you can check how close we are to dominance of V. If V is very, very large, that ratio is minus one. Okay? If V is very, very small, that ratio is one. Because this is gone and that divides that, it's one, right? So the ratio is always between one and minus one. If the potential is unimportant, that ratio is one. If V is very important, is very dominant, the ratio is minus one. So here's that number. It is the pressure divided by the energy density. It's this divided by that. It's a number that's always between minus one and plus one. The ratio between pressure and energy density comes up in thermodynamics a lot, chemistry and so on. There it is called the equation of state parameter, the ratio between pressure and energy density. So cosmologists continue that terminology. That ratio is called the equation of state parameter. Look out for when it becomes close to minus one, because that is the case where the potential is dominant, where the potential starts playing a role, just like a cosmological constant. So let us pursue our first attempt to describe a period of exponential expansion in the universe. What could be the mechanics of that? What could cause it? What could cause exponential expansion? Okay, first attempt is this. We make an assumption, namely that the cosmological constant is dominating the scene very early in the universe. So let's say the cosmological constant is the main contribution to the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. It dominates over the energy momentum tensor completely. Well, then, let's just look at the zero-zero component of the Einstein equation. That already will tell us all we need to know. This is the zero-zero component of the Einstein equation. Our assumption is the cosmological constant dominates, which means compared to the size of this, we can neglect that. Which is nice, because that's a constant, whereas this is a complicated function of phi. Right? T naught naught is the energy density caused by the Klein-Gordon field. Under this assumption here, this is just negligible. And therefore, all of this time dependence drops out. And we can immediately tell what the solution is going to be for the scale factor. Namely, a dot over a squared is then 1/3 of lambda. And clearly, the solution to that is exponential. I don't know what happened there. Some dark forces at work here. Okay, okay, there we go. So what we find is that if the cosmological constant dominates, or when it dominated, then the expansion is exponential. Just plug it in here, and you find that the expansion rate is given by square root of lambda third. So the larger the cosmological constant, the faster is the exponential expansion, right? We just solve that equation here. So we get a tremendous Hubble constant, a very small Hubble radius, very small Hubble horizon, if the cosmological constant is very large. So we seem to be in business here. That's what we wanted. We wanted the mechanism that makes the universe expand exponentially quickly. There is trouble, though. This cannot be the explanation. First of all, the cosmological constant is really small. It is extremely small. It is 122 orders of magnitude smaller than the Planck scale. So we need, but we, what we would need is a lambda, is the cosmological constant, which is close to the Planck scale. Just to give you an idea, the Planck scale would be, if lambda were at the Planck scale, it would have a value of about 10 to the power 70 per meter squared. In fact, the cosmological constant has been measured because it shows up as a vacuum energy. It contributes to the overall energy budget in the universe. In fact, it's the major contribution. 70% of all energy in the universe is the cosmological constant. And about 25% or so is dark matter, and then the rest is visible matter. So it affects the evolution of the universe, and it can clearly be measured. So the cosmological constant has been measured, and it is very small. Its value is about 10 to the minus 52 per meter squared. 10 to the minus 52 per meter squared, whereas for the purpose of generating inflation, we would need it to be 10 to the 70. Lambda is not going to do it. Now you might say, well, okay, but maybe we had a different cosmological constant at the beginning of the universe than now. Cannot do. It's a constant. It's a constant. And it's only a cosmological constant if it really is constant. Otherwise, it messes everything up. You can't just put a cosmological constant in the Einstein action just like that. It's only consistent if it really is a constant. The next best term after a constant is the Ricci scalar, and then higher order terms. So there's no room to maneuver here. The cosmological constant cannot have cost an initial period of rapid inflation. So then what is a realistic possibility? Well, realistic is that the potential was temporarily very large, because that achieves the same thing as the cosmological constant in principle. It can be arbitrarily large, as we will see, and it can be arbitrarily large only temporarily, because this is not a constant. The potential can change. It can go from small to large to small. So you can have a situation where it goes from small to large, the universe expands like crazy, and then it goes to small, and the universe's expansion slows down at that point. So that gets us to one of the biggest ideas ever. Consider a universe just like ours. It has houses and cars and everything. And there's curvature. It's not flat, it's not empty, it's some realistic universe. Then, since quantum theory is the law of the land, at all times, everywhere, quantum fields fluctuate. Not much, at least not on large scales. And normally, those quantum fluctuations play only a little role, only a small role in daily life. But what can happen is, as a rare fluke, if you wait long enough, and if you search for it far enough, you might find that a rare fluke occurs. Namely, a fluke where the quantum field phi fluctuates such that, to a value such that its potential V of phi is tremendously large. So whatever the potential of phi is, normally, phi will not fluctuate very much such that the potential is a very large value. That's suppressed. But it's possible. Now imagine that this happens not on a tremendously large scale, but on a small patch only of that universe. So there's a universe, and in it there's a small patch, perhaps just a few Planck lengths across. And imagine that on that patch, the field happens to undergo a quantum fluctuation such that the value of the field means that the V of phi, that the potential of the field in that patch, is very much elevated. And by very much, I mean very much, like almost Planck energy. Probably a very rare occurrence, but might happen. Now, if you have a Planck energy distribution, if you have a distribution of energy here that's Planckian or almost Planckian, you would expect that gravity takes notice. But how does it take notice of it? Well, when V of phi is very large, it acts like a temporary cosmological constant. And that means exponential expansion. So in any universe that allows for scalar fields like that, you find that the universe is unstable. Having a scalar field around means the universe is unstable, because there is always a chance that you have in a large enough patch a large energy density, V of phi, which then, through the Einstein equations, makes the underlying space-time just in that patch grow almost exponential, almost exponentially. Ordinarily, you would have the following situation. A quantum fluctuation happens, a small one. Gravity reacts a little bit, but the fluctuation just snaps back. And it was just overall a virtual fluctuation. But sometimes the fluctuation is just too big. It's so big that it triggers this reaction of space-time to grow so much that other degrees of freedom will witness that. And then it will decohere and become a real fluctuation. It's just like when you have radioactive decay. Let's say there is an alpha particle in a nucleus. It wants out. Classically, it cannot, because the potential is too strong. It's bound. But quantum mechanically, it can tunnel. So you can imagine that what's going on is that the alpha particle will try to get out, but the potential keeps pushing it back. But and so the wave function sort of leaks out a little bit. It keeps trying. And at some point, the fluctuation will be large enough so that it will make it out. And then what used to be just virtual fluctuations become a real fluctuation. It has actually decayed, because there are now other particles around that witness, this has happened. This thing has decayed. So similarly, a small patch of this universe can mushroom out and become a sort of daughter universe. It can grow very big. Because remember, if you just do it for 10 to the minus 32 seconds, this can generate something that is way bigger than the universe that we see. Not just a few billion light years across, but, you know, a one with 100,000 zeros. Why do we need that it is a patch of some finite size that is a few Planck lengths across? Do you have any idea why you need that? That the potential is fairly homogeneous there on a patch that's not quite a point, but somehow extended? It's because we don't want derivatives of the field to compete with V of phi. Because in the energy and pressure budget, we had derivatives of the field as well. So we're assuming here that those derivatives are small, so that our argument is true that V of phi dominates over the derivative terms. And therefore, V of phi acts by contributing positively to the energy density, negatively to the pressure, dominates both, and therefore acts like a cosmological constant, inducing exponential growth. So that patch then just blows up like this. So we arrive at the conclusion that a universe that has a scalar field is unstable in principle. Very rarely, but possibly it could spawn daughter universes, which could then spawn several other daughter universes, and so on. There is a huge, not only does this explain how you can have the effect, a similar effect to a cosmological constant arise, but it also explains how this comes to an end again and what acts like a cosmological constant goes away. We need that, of course, too, because we know that we are not living in a universe that's still expanding at that rate with the Hubble horizon of 10 to the minus 29 meters or so. So if this was in our past, how come it actually slowed down eventually? Now, the V of phi has its own dynamics, because phi has a dynamics. Therefore, as the field phi evolves, the potential will evolve as well. As we will see, the equations of motion are such that naturally the potential will go down. Not much of a surprise, right? But that's what it will do. The potential will eventually, I mean, the field will evolve such as to reduce the value of its potential energy. And that will reduce the effective Hubble constant, the Hubble parameter, until inflation ends. And what you see here is that if this scenario is right, we have a firm prediction that the Hubble constant during inflation was not really a constant. The Hubble constant must have changed in time, because the potential must have changed in time, otherwise inflation would have never ended. Right? So the potential must have slowly gone down in time, which means that the Hubble length must have slowly increased. The Hubble parameter must have slowly decreased, and the Hubble parameter must have slowly decreased. The Hubble length must have slowly increased, the Hubble parameter slowly decreased, and the quantum fluctuations that are being caught must have decreased in amplitude. And as I mentioned earlier, there is now evidence for this tilt in the spectrum. And what happens to all that energy that was in that quantum fluctuation V of phi? Well, it turns out it's quite a bit of energy. It started out as a tiny patch where the V of phi was elevated. But then, during the exponential expansion, this value of V of phi was established everywhere. It would seem like this is a way to get energy out of nothing, a lot of energy out of very little energy. And that's what it is. Yes, there is no energy conservation in general relativity. So even though initially we had elevated V of phi only in here, space-time expanded underneath it, and the potential, as you will see later with the actual equations of motion, the potential stays almost the same as the universe expands. It only very slowly goes down to a lower value, the energy density. So the energy density is high all over the place. Eventually, when the energy density drops down, that energy density has to go somewhere, and it goes into the production of all sorts of particles. So when inflation ends, a lot of energy is available, and that energy, or that energy density, goes into the production of particles, which will create a very hot, dense soup of all sorts of particles. And that's basically the start, then, of the ordinary Big Bang cosmology, where the universe doesn't start with a singularity here, but it starts with a universe that is filled with a very, very hot gas made out of everything available, all particles available. And a universe that's very much flat, doesn't have curvature. The reason being that this inflation will inflate away all possible ripples that space-time might have had here in this mother universe. It's just like when you balloon and blow it up, it might have wrinkles initially, but after you blow it up, it ions them out. Strictly speaking, it doesn't actually iron them out. It just makes them bigger in wavelength. But overall, it will look very, very smooth in any finite patch after so much expansion. So just a sec. So we after inflation, we end up with a universe that's both very flat spatially and filled with a hot gas, tremendously hot gas, made out of everything. This explains yet another mystery of cosmology that cosmologists have wondered a long time about, which is the question why the universe started out so tremendously flat. Remember that flatness is not a stable state for the universe. The universe is a little bit positively curved. It wants to become more positively curved. If it is a little bit negatively curved, it wants to become more negatively curved. That's just how the Einstein equations work. So the fact that the universe now is pretty flat means that in the past it must have been flat with enormous precision. And this process enforces that because you have an expansion by many, many, many orders of magnitude, which just flattens out everything. Even though this patch, this explosion might have happened in a region of significant curvature, so what? After so many orders of magnitude of expansion, all traces of curvature have been ironed out. Yep?
I mean, this description here, it starts from a spontaneous vacuum fluctuation.
Yes.
It has an elevated energy density.
Yeah.
Well, could the central singularity in a black hole also do that?
Oh, well, a singularity itself is a point where the theory is not defined. Yes, we don't know what's happening there. But close to the singularity, yes, all sorts of things might happen. Wild fluctuation. Nobody knows really how to describe that. We still have quite a bit to cover today. can we postpone those questions to later? Okay. I just didn't want to rush this. Okay, so turns into matter. So here is an example potential. Remember, the infratron field needs a potential. It could be as simple as phi squared, m phi squared. It could be phi to the 4 or something like that, but it needs some sort of potential. And the textbook example of a potential where this sort of scenario happens very easily is this one. You will find that in textbooks a lot, even though nowadays perhaps the phi squared potential is favored. Okay, so example potential. Imagine you have a scalar field in the standard model, which has a potential that looks like this. It's a little odd, perhaps, because the lowest energy value of the field is not for phi equals 0, but for phi equal to phi c, some value there. So the lowest energy value is here. That's not an important thing. That's not what makes the inflation happen. You could switch this thing around with having the minimum over there, and then the potential goes up like that, right? Doesn't matter. It's just I wanted to use the textbook examples, so I stuck to this way of writing it. A potential like that you get, for example, from phi to the 4th minus phi squared. You get something like this. You know, this famous Mexican hat potential, for example. But this could also be, you know, some phi squared or so. Around there. Anyway, let's look at this case. So ordinarily, the field will have a value around here. And it will quantum fluctuate around that value. But then there might be a quantum fluctuation such that the field value is somewhere over here. It might just quantum fluctuate this way. This is rare because it's energetically expensive, but it can happen. You know, you can calculate the statistics of quantum fluctuations also in the presence of a potential, just like we earlier in the course calculated the statistics of quantum fluctuations in the absence of a potential. You can also calculate it with a potential, and unsurprisingly, if there's a potential, it can penalize the quantum fluctuations that would create a lot of energy. But it can still happen. That's why you can tunnel. All right, so imagine we have a universe in which there's a scalar field that has this potential. Everywhere in the universe, the field is playing around, quantum fluctuating, a little bit around here. But at some point in time, at some place in space, it might just fluctuate over there. And not just at a point, but in a significantly large patch, a few Planck lengths across, homogeneously, so that the derivatives don't matter. In that case, we have that in this little patch, the potential is very large. V of phi is very large, almost the Planck energy. Then, as we will see later in the equation of motion, the Einstein equations will force the universe to undergo exponential expansion, or almost exponential expansion, while at the same time, the Klein-Gordon field, phi, wants to return to the lower energy state. So the equation of motion of the phi field, the Klein-Gordon equation, will describe the phi field to go from this value back to the minimum value, the potential therefore to go from this high value to eventually down to the minimum value again. And remember, all of that energy density, as the universe expands, you see, if the phi value starts out here due to the quantum fluctuation, goes all the way over there, the universe expands, the universe expands. The energy density is established all over the universe where it is expanding. I mean, just this mushrooming thing, right? Not to the left and right of the patch. And then eventually that energy density, as inflation ends, you see the energy density goes down, and the energy density goes into the production of particles. As the field arrives over here, the potential energy is gone, and we have a very hot universe at that point. So the universe no longer expands exponentially. It typically expands with some power law, as it is doing today. And and it is filled with a very hot gas. So let's put some mass to this. Here's the Klein-Gordon equation for, in the case of isotropy and homogeneity. So we are just looking at the zero modes, remember? This is just the phi of t that we are studying here. It's a constant phi, as phi is constant in space. We have only time dependence, right? It's the overall value of phi. Later, we will study spatial fluctuations of phi, the quantum fluctuations around the constant phi. But for now, let's just do the classical physics of a Klein-Gordon field, the inflaton field, interacting with the classical general relativity. So here's the Klein-Gordon equation for a Klein-Gordon field that depends only on time, not on space, in an expanding universe. And what we find here is that the Klein-Gordon equation looks like this. And we can visualize it like a ball rolling down a hill, because we have here a second derivative of phi. That's just like in classical mechanics, the acceleration. Here we have a potential that we differentiate. So this is like the force. It's like, you know, it's a gradient of the potential, right? It's the slope of it, the slope of the potential. And you see that if that was absent, we would have that this thing just, you know, goes down the potential here. It's the negative sign, so, you know, it goes down the potential. This, however, is a term that's proportional to phi dot. That's a friction term. So overall, this is the same equation of motion as what you would expect if you describe some object that's sliding down here with some friction. It's not an object sliding down with some friction, but the equation of motion is the same. So we see that as the universe is expanding almost exponentially in that period, phi will just slowly go down here. And as phi, as the value of V of phi slowly decreases, this is not supposed to be completely flat, right? It has a bit of a slope. As the value of V of phi slowly decreases, we have that the Hubble parameter slowly decreases. And the exponential, the quasi-exponential expansion also decreases its acceleration a little bit until eventually inflation ends over there. Okay, so minus dV by d phi acts to pull phi close to that value of zero potential, and this acts as a friction term. I already mentioned that. Here's a definition. This is what is called slow roll inflation. Slow roll because of the analogy with the ball going down here. It's called slow roll because there's an assumption of this being a small slope, so that it rolls quite a while there. The longer it does roll there, the more the universe expands, of course. But remember, the whole thing from here to there probably took not more than 10 to the minus 32 seconds. So what we observe is that during this slow roll period, we have that V of phi dominates over 1/2 phi dot squared. Okay, so that's because we make the assumption that the potential of the field, of the Klein-Gordon field, of the inflaton field, is such that this plateau over here, almost plateau, is at close to the Planckian energy. If so, then that quantum fluctuations all the way to here brings the potential up to a value that's almost the Planck energy, which is way bigger than the cosmological constant. And if the patch is large enough, where this is homogeneously the case, then this is completely dominant. And we have exponential expansion, and our so-called equation of state parameter, pressure over energy density, is approximately minus 1, temporarily. Let's see if we really get temporary, almost exponential inflation. Here is the Einstein equation again. And during the slow roll period, we have that the cosmological constant doesn't matter. Remember, it's by many orders of magnitude too small. And this term, T naught naught, is dominated by the potential. It's just that. Right? The T naught naught really has kinetic terms in it, derivatives, space and time derivatives of the field. But we're assuming that the potential dominates over the space and time derivatives of the field. So therefore, T naught naught is basically given just by V. And so the Einstein equation becomes that. And during the slow roll period, therefore, we have that A dot over A is given basically by the potential, and the solution is basically an exponential. Basically exponential inflation. Not quite. This equation, this is almost the solution to this. Not quite, because phi is time dependent. V of phi is time dependent. Therefore, this is not really a constant. Therefore, this exponential is not really a solution. However, we are assuming here, to write that, we are assuming that phi is changing slowly compared to the expansion of the universe. And therefore, we have that the scale factor is really almost exponentially depending on V of phi. As phi slowly changes, V slowly changes, and this is the temporary H. This is the temporary Hubble parameter. That thing is really time dependent, right? But it's a very good approximation to a solution to that. But as we anticipated earlier, we obtain a time dependent, a slowly time dependent Hubble parameter, and therefore a slowly time dependent Hubble horizon, and therefore slowly time-dependent, weakly time-dependent quantum fluctuation amplification. Because late modes will cross the horizon when it is already a little larger. Remember, a universe that doesn't inflate at all has an infinite horizon size. The faster it is expanding, the smaller is the horizon size. So A dot over A is slowly changing, and we used to call it the Hubble constant, but since it's slowly changing, it's a Hubble parameter. And it is given by this expression in terms of the time-dependent potential. Nowadays, the measurements are so precise of the quantum fluctuations spectrum over wavelength, which indirectly gives us the quantum fluctuations spectrum over time, because they cross the horizon one after the other. That gives us a good handle on measuring h of t, and it has actually been measured to some extent now. Which means that we basically have a measurement of v. Not very precise. So far, we basically have the amplitude, the first derivative, and a hint about the second derivative. But it's the start for Taylor expansion for what the potential might be. So the latest results indicate that the Hubble radius is actually used to be a little smaller than first thought, maybe just 3 orders of magnitude larger than the Planck length, which places it very close to the Planck scale. So there is a chance, as we said earlier, the Planck scale physics might show up in actual observations. So now is the time to make predictions, because if you wait too long, you will be making post-diction. Right? It's much better to have a good prediction than a post-diction. So as I said, you know, if you work on quantum gravity, try to see what it does. Just feed it into the study of the quantum fluctuations that we do in this course, and see what your quantum gravity theory predicts for how the predictions of inflationary cosmology are modified. Okay, so how about the end of inflation? I think I mentioned already all of these things. We have inflation happening from here to here as the field rolls down that hill. And then as it is going down the slope, the energy density of the inflaton field gets transformed into the by production of all sorts of particles. That process is called reheating, even though there was no heating before. I don't know why they called it like that. Okay, so we need to make all of these things much more precise. Remember, our assumption was that we have a scalar field in nature which has some suitable potential V of phi. For example, the Higgs field is a scalar field, but its potential is not quite the right one. It doesn't seem to have such a slope that reaches up to the Planck scale in the right way. So we have to assume that there's another scalar field in nature that has the right potential. In principle, we can deduce from that that the universe is unstable. And this process of the nucleation or mushrooming out of a new daughter universe can happen. Because we have these temporary periods of quantum fluctuations, if strong enough, can become real, because the effect is so large that it gets witnessed and therefore decohered. Now, in order to calculate the quantum fluctuations that are supposed to have seeded the structure in the universe explicitly, we have to be more careful than we were in the past. We will allow small inhomogeneities, first of all, in the inflaton field. Remember, most of this course, we assumed that space-time was expanding very rapidly for whatever reason. It was just assumed given. It will have this scale factor A of t. And then we considered a scalar field and asked, how does it react to this? In practice, the situation is a bit different, because the scalar field, as we just saw, is probably the cause of that exponential expansion. And the quantum fluctuations of that scalar field will also locally back react onto space-time. And on top of that, space-time itself will also quantum fluctuate. So how do we describe this complicated, intricate interplay between quantum fluctuations and the big dynamics? For that purpose, we write the inflaton field as the sum of two contributions. One is the inflaton field bulk contribution. It's zero mode. It's the part of it that doesn't depend on space. It's the overall behavior of the inflaton field. It's what we just calculated earlier. In the homogeneous isotropy limit, or under the assumption of homogeneity and isotropy. So we're decomposing our inflaton field into a field that doesn't depend on space, it's constant in space, plus small fluctuations around that. This is a good assumption because, we can always decompose a field in this way, but why is it a good assumption that this is small compared to that? That's a good assumption because even if in that mother universe, the inflaton field had some significant amplitude variations, after so much expansion of space-time, all of that should have been flattened out. So it's a good assumption to say that the inflaton field starts out being basically constant field with whatever value, depends on the dynamics that we just discussed, plus small perturbations that can depend on space. And it is then a legal approximation to say we treat this part classically. This is the part that interferes with the Einstein equation and makes the big changes. It is the part that generates the mushrooming out. It is the part that drives the exponential expansion. And then that part, which describes just the small fluctuations around total homogeneity, that part we will quantize and study the fluctuations. So we will study what are the position-dependent quantum fluctuations of the field. So in hindsight, the field that we studied through this course was really that one. And we are not even done yet. It will become even more complicated a little later. Okay, so the inflaton field will be decomposed into a part that's only time-dependent, not space-dependent, whose amplitude may be large, perhaps even very large. And in addition, some quantum fluctuations around that. Some fluctuations around that can be space and time dependent that we will quantize by the usual methods. Now, it's more complicated though, because also the metric ultimately is something that can quantum fluctuate. So we will write the metric as the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, which can be put in this form. Remember that the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric is conformally conformally equivalent to Minkowski space by using the co-moving coordinates and conformal time. The Friedman-Robertson metric takes this form. So we will express the metric as this metric. That's what we've done all the time so far. But in order to become realistic, we have to add extra perturbations to the metric. The metric may not be completely constant all over space and time, all over space. So we allow for perturbations to the metric, and those we will quantize. We do the quantum theory of those fluctuations, of the metric fluctuations. And the big deal on Monday was that was measured, the quantization of these guys, the impact of those. But let's be a little bit more precise, because what was measured was part of these guys. The metric tensor, the perturbation of the metric tensor can be decomposed into three types of perturbations. Namely, there is a type of of perturbation, as a type of symmetric covariant to tensor, which can be derived from scalar functions. For example, such a gamma mu could be a scalar times eta mu nu. Okay? That would be a legal perturbation, just a scalar times eta mu nu. In this case, yes, it's an addition to the metric. It has the right index structure and all, but it's just derived from a scalar. Or similarly, we could write down a perturbation of the metric gamma, which is simply the second derivative of a scalar. You differentiate in the mu direction, differentiate in the nu direction. It's a covariant thing to do. And you get a suitable tensor in this way. You can write down a perturbation of the metric in this way. But it's not truly tensorial in character, because it's just a derivative of a scalar. So there are perturbations to the metric which can be expressed in terms of scalars only. Similarly, there are perturbations of the metric that can be expressed in terms of vector fields. For example, such a perturbation could be simply obtained by taking a vector field mu, a vector field v, let's say, and you just write down v index mu times v index nu. It's symmetric. It obeys the criterions for, being a perturbation of the metric. Yes, it's a perturbation of the metric, But it's not truly tensorial. It's derivable from a vector field. And then there are contributions to the metric which are neither not derivable from scalars, not derivable from vectors, truly tensorial. There are three types of perturbations to the metric. This, by the way, is very similar to the situation in electrodynamics, where you take a vector field, let's say the electric field, and you can decompose the electric field always. I hope you remember that. You can always decompose the vector field of the electric field into a gradient part and a curl part. The curl part is the curl of another vector field. The gradient part is the gradient of a scalar. And it is fair to say that the gradient part is really scalar in origin. It's a vector field, all right. A gradient field is a vector field, but it's completely determined by giving a vector, a scalar function, right? Whereas the curl is truly vectorial in the sense that it's derived from a vector field. And so this is the same deal, just with more and more index. Now we have a two tensor that we decompose into a part that derives from a scalar or from scalars, a part that derives from vectors, and a part that's truly tensorial. Okay, so this decomposition is convenient. Because when you do that decomposition in the Einstein equation, you find out that the three contributions to the metric have independent equations of motion. They decouple to first order. If you linearize, if you just linearize the equations of motion to get for each one its analog Klein-Gödel equation, for each contribution of to the metric perturbations, you find that they decouple. And what we will find here, and then just anticipating this we will do this in more detail in the next lecture, there is a scalar part to the metric fluctuations, as we just discussed, and that scalar part will couple through the Einstein equation to the inflaton field. So they will influence each other, and in fact, they will have a common dynamics. It is not really separable. You can't really say it's the field phi that fluctuates and that drives the fluctuations of the scalar part of the metric, or the scalar part of the metric fluctuates and that drives the fluctuations of the inflaton field. They drive each other. And then there's also the vector fluctuations. However, the vector fluctuations are not important in cosmology because they don't experience this vacuum fluctuation amplification effect. The tensorial part of the metric, however, the tensorial part of the metric fluctuation, the one that cannot be derived from scalars or vectors, that tensorial part has its own independent degrees of freedom, its own equations of motion. In fact, they are basically the Klein-Gödel equation. And those quantum fluctuations, and therefore there ought to be quantum fluctuations of the truly tensorial part of the metric. And it has been studied for many years how those quantum fluctuations should manifest themselves. It turns out that those truly tensorial fluctuations of the metric, quantum fluctuations of the metric, should have left an imprint in the polarization, in the pattern of polarization on the cosmic microwave background. And that's what they reported on Monday, that they saw that. They saw this polarization pattern according to prediction. So that's the big deal. It used to be thought that those quantum fluctuations are very small in amplitude and therefore would not be visible over the foreground contamination from all the stuff that's in the universe between us and the cosmic microwave background emitting gas. But apparently, the acceleration during inflation was so strong that the quantum fluctuations even of the metric of the tensorial part of the metric, were amplified so much that they are producing a signal in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background that is strong enough to be seen over the foreground contamination. Okay, so you see, now our task splits in two. We have to quantize these guys, the quantum fluctuations of the tensorial part of the metric, which can be seen in the polarization of the CMB, and we have to quantize the scalar degree of freedom, that is a combination of the inflaton field and the scalar part of the metric, the two being coupled through the Einstein equation. Okay, so that's what we will do next. We will quantize those two things, the tensorial part and the scalar part, which is coupled to the inflaton field.